and I sat still without any technology. I really cried for her then. Before, I had cried from discomfort and I had cried for my mom, but now, in an empty row of airport seating, I thought about my grandma. I'd be lying if I said we were extremely close. Both of my older cousins had spent more time with her as they grew up, and I was envious of the relationships they had. But she had bathed me in her sink and taught me to read, and she'd been a moral standard my whole life. She was a devout woman, and even though I am not, I fully expect that she is in the illustrated children's Bible version of heaven. If she was on some plane now where she could see my soul laid bare, I wondered if she would be proud of me. I got on my flight to Vancouver. We landed, I got my work permit, made it through customs, and checked into my hotel. I'd been awake for 32 hours, but I still ordered a burger and a vodka because sometimes you can't call it a day until something good happens. The next day, Sunday, I filmed a scene with Shia LaBeouf and Terrence Howard. Those actors have reputations for being eccentric, but both of them were sensitive, warm, and professional, which I needed more than they could have known. But in retrospect, it's kind of a disappointment. Mr. Redford was equally lovely. In one shot at the end of the night, my character is looking at an image of Redford as a young man. In between takes, he came up behind me, looked at the photo, sighed wistfully, and said, "God, I had fun." My stomach flipped, and I hoped that if my grandmother was hanging out in my soul, she got a kick out of that. That night, I showered and got on a plane back to the Pitch Perfect set. When we touched down in Baton Rouge, it was Monday morning. I don't actually remember if I went to my room and showered before going to set. I hope for the sake of my coworkers I had time. We were filming the finale performance and I was glad to have something physical to focus on. Some of the cast asked me how the Redford thing went, but it seemed most did not know anything else had happened. Working regularly has only made it harder to get home. Even when I'm not shooting, I have so many side projects that I have to check with about 5 different departments in my life to ask permission to visit. Sometimes I fantasize about leaving LA and living on a little boat off the coast of Maine so I could see my family whenever I want. I doubt my hectic brain would let me do that. Plus, I don't think Seamless does maritime deliveries. I used to joke about turning down certain movies that had explicit content because my grandmother's alive and I'd like to keep it that way. I thought about that as we continued to film the movie. It was only a joke, of course, but the day that I shouted, "That's my dick!" I thought it was probably for the best that my grandmother would never see Pitch Perfect. Fake parties I have planned with the detail of a real party. Now that I'm doing my dream job, I fantasize about a social life. I know what you're thinking. But Anna, everything you've said in this book makes you sound so fun to be around. You must have literally thousands of friends at your beck and call. Sadly, even if that were true, it is. I'm very well liked, and anyone who tells you otherwise is just frightened by the power of their love for me. I barely have time to see anyone. Usually when I am at home, I've just come back from months out of town, and I only have the energy to pick various essentials out of my oversized luggage day by day, leaving a trail of laundry, heat styling tools, and half-empty bottles of face wash in every room. But even though my place is in a state of perpetual squalor, and I've got a maximum of 3 solid relationships in my life at any given moment, I've always dreamed of being a world-class hostess. I'm talking about chic-ass, highly detailed, suck-on-that-Pinterest-style parties. These are just a few of the classy, imaginary bashes I have thrown. Christmas. Christmas is the ultimate party opportunity. It's the only holiday that has whole categories of food, alcohol, and music dedicated to it. The decor can be elegant and traditional, modern and monochromatic, or whimsical and eclectic. If I could have my house decorated for Christmas year-round, I'd do it. In fact, if I could have nothing in my house but Christmas decor, that would be ideal. Seriously, if it were up to me, I wouldn't even have furniture. Wait, it is up to me? Oh, shit. So I'm not really interested in interior design beyond tiny lights and tacky snow globes. One day I might start faking a romantic madness like a rich spinster in a Victorian novel so I can live in a winter wonderland full time. I hate Christmas itself. It's nothing but a source of anxiety and disappointment. But like getting naked with a hot guy, I like the idea of it. My house is on a narrow winding street off several other narrow winding streets. It's hard to find and parking is minimal. My neighbors are so mean about parking that when I moved in, I thought they were doing a comedy bit. I playfully yelled back at them until the day I realized they just legit hated me. This makes it complicated to throw my ultimate imaginary Christmas soiree, but I have a festive solution. I rent out a parking lot at the bottom of the hill and hire a team of drivers for the evening. Did I mention that I spare no expense on my imaginary parties? Guests drop off their vehicles in the lot and get into one of a small fleet of town cars waiting to take them to my front door. Not only is pre-selected Christmas music playing in the car, but the interior is decorated to the nines. Lit garland along the windows, red velvet across the seats, tiny dishes of potpourri in the cup holders. The drivers will have a simple sprig of holly in their lapels. No Santa hats. A grown man in a Santa hat always looks like a dog in a sweater. They might put up with it, but you can tell they hate you for it. The outside of my house would put the Griswolds to shame. The very nature of light-up outdoor decor is garish, so I support going all out. I've even got a Santa on the roof and a bunch of those animatronic reindeer on the front lawn. Fuck the environment. It's Christmas! To get through the door, guests have to sing their favorite Christmas carol. Just the first line, I'm not a monster. And then they are presented with an assortment of holiday beverages. Wassail, aka hot cider with booze, mulled wine, or eggnog with spiced rum. Served by an attractive waiter on a silver filigree platter, Natch. The inside of my place would be decked out. And not just the living room, every inch of my house would look like a Christmas-themed playland. I've always hated that moment at holiday parties when you catch a glimpse into some nautical-inspired guest room and remember that Christmas is just a farce designed to distract us from the existential dread and monotony of our pathetic, meaningless lives and good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen. But that won't happen at my party. Anyone could walk into any room to put down their coat or snoop through my shit. Nice try, suckers. I buried everything embarrassing in the backyard in preparation for this party. Without breaking the holiday spirit. The food would be inspired by Game of Thrones. Did you know there are websites dedicated to creating recipes inspired by the dishes described in the books and on the show? Obviously, I've hired someone who runs a GOT food site to cater. I'm too busy sexually harassing the waiters to cook anything myself. Don't worry. They all find me charming, not lecherous and entitled. No, really. It's like how every guy I know has told me a story about going to Hooters and how the waitress seemed grateful to finally have a customer who was cool and fun. Definitely not bullshit. There's a game of Yankee Swap with gag gifts once everyone is drunk enough to think that a shake weight is hilarious. Then a Will Ferrell impersonator performs a scene from Elf once everyone is drunk enough to think that it's actually Will Ferrell. Even though it's my fantasy, I don't like the idea that the real Will Ferrell would be willing to come to some jerk's Christmas party for money. Everyone gets sent home with a gift bag of candy, the Michael Bublé holiday album, and a very tasteful, very delicate gold necklace in a box buried at the bottom so they won't discover it until they get home, and then they'll think what a thoughtful, generous friend I am. Is it extravagant? Yes. But it's my imaginary money, and I'll spend it how I please. Since everyone's hammered, the drivers take guests home safely and work in teams through the night to return their cars by morning. There's a thank you note on the windshield, because I have thought of everything. Valentine's Day. I think the single gal's anti-Valentine's Day thing is a little played out. The romantic Valentine's thing is a little played out, too. I also know that every dude thinks this holiday is a trap. Your lady says she doesn't want to exchange gifts or do anything special, but secretly, she wants you to surprise her with something anyway. I don't think ladies actually trap men like this, but if you're a lady who does this, cut it out. You're proving those boring dudes right. Perhaps a Valentine's Day party should be left to someone better versed in romance. I'm sort of the cooler when it comes to hooking up. I don't want you to think I'm not fun. I'm just the kind of gal who will find a book of anonymous World War I letters at a house party and sneak away from my crush to read them. Half an hour later, he will find me weeping. He'll tell me to rejoin the party and I'll reply, but it's all just so sad. I think about that book more often than I think about that boy. Nevertheless, I have a potential V-Day party plan. My imaginary Valentine's Day party is a mock restaurant at my house. I cook a little something, dim the lights, and arrange some candles. It's not like you can get a reservation anywhere else, so just come over, have a seat at a hastily decorated folding table, and don't complain about the food because the chef will spit in your dessert. Couples, singles, gay, straight, cats, dogs, and well-trained lizards are welcome. No babies. If everyone feels like finishing the evening with an orgy, all the better. St. Patrick's Day. I grew up in a mostly Irish community and everyone took their heritage pretty seriously. I was plain shocked when I came to LA and found people treating St. Patrick's Day like a Kermit-colored Mardi Gras. My St. Patrick's Day party would take authentic Celtic inspiration, none of this neon green tomfoolery. Guests are required to wear an Aran Island cable knit, and they will be provided with a flat cap and a wooden pipe at the door. A bartender will be present, but only to continually dry the inside of a glass with a rag and supportively nod his head. The beer will be self-serve, and brown, thank you very much, green beer looks like radioactive piss. And the food will be Italian, not Irish, because I don't hate my friends. If I invite family, I'll have to hide anything that looks valuable. They wouldn't steal anything, but they would certainly get drunk and start throwing around terms like hoity-toity and asking if I thought I was better than them. A confession booth will be available, But I'll find some Unitarian minister and he or she will hand out absolution like it's flavored vodka at an Iggy Azalea album release party. It won't get you into heaven, but it'll be over quickly. Public urination will be acceptable. Dirty limericks will receive much bigger laughs than they deserve, and no one can talk about their feelings until they're blind drunk. The party game will be a snake piñata to commemorate St. Patrick driving the snakes out of Ireland. Yes, I know he didn't actually do that, and the snakes are druids or pagans or whatever, and it's all some big allegory. Just hit the piñata, all right? You think you're better than me? New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve is the holiday that needs an anti-party. Girls started doing anti-Valentines in protest of the outlandish expectations of that day. But for my money, New Year's Eve is the worst of the high-pressure, forced fun offenders. Plus, champagne is the devil's work, and even the expensive shit makes me weepy and bloated. This imaginary event is not catered, valeted, or overly planned. Come over in sweats and slippers. If you don't have any, I can provide them, not because I bought them in preparation, but because I love sweats and slippers, and I happen to own enough to outfit a small, very comfortable army. No makeup, no champagne, no you're leaving already, goodbye, guilt, and absolutely no glitter. There will be Jenga, jigsaw puzzles, wine, whatever I have in my fridge, probably condiments in an empty Brita, maybe a stand-up special on Netflix, and hopefully some decent gossip about whoever didn't make it. I don't know what we'll do at midnight because there will be no countdown. And if you're cool with me falling asleep mid-party, you can stay as long as you want. Thanksgiving. I adore an orphan's Thanksgiving. I love my family, but Thanksgiving with friends feels awesome because I grew up watching TV shows about people who seemed to have no connection outside of their friend group, office, or community college. The magic comes from the playing house quality that makes you feel more grown up and more childlike simultaneously. In my dream version, the menu is as follows. Dinner. Individual cranberry baked brie puff pastries. Brussels sprouts with caramelized onions and crispy bacon. Fried mac and cheese balls with truffle oil. Buttery jalapeno cornbread. Lobster mashed potatoes. Garlic and herb stuffed mushrooms. Roasted butternut squash with maple glazed pecans. Prosciutto wrapped asparagus spears. Cranberry sauce out of the can. Turkey, I guess. Desserts. Pumpkin pie. Pumpkin creme brulee, pumpkin cake with honey cream cheese frosting, pumpkin cheesecake bars, pumpkin whoopie pies, pumpkin Swiss roll. I will defend pumpkin until the day I die. It's delicious. It's healthy. I don't understand the backlash. How did pumpkin become this embarrassing thing to love, but bacon is still the cool flavor to add to everything? I don't have anything against bacon. Just don't come after pumpkin like it's a crime to love an American staple. Activities will include pretending to help in the kitchen, watching the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and saying you're so full you're gonna throw up, then waiting 10 minutes and getting more pie. Once the sun has been down for a couple of hours, the Christmas season is technically upon us, so it's time for the first Harry Potter marathon of the year, starting with film number 3, because obviously, and ending with film 5 when the filthy casuals are allowed to go home. The hardcores can sleep at my place and in the morning we'll finish film 6, 7, and 7, but where stuff happens, pumpkin pie for breakfast. Batten down the hatches. My friend Whitney is obsessed with the ocean. She decorates her Christmas tree with seashells and starfish and says things like, "Logically, I know they're not, but I just feel like mermaids are real." Whitney invites Alex and me sailing shortly after I turn 21. She and her family make an annual trip to Catalina, a truly tiny island off the coast of California, for an event called Buccaneer Days. I've heard Whitney talk about this event before, but I still don't understand what it is. Is it a costume contest? Is it a boat race? It's an excuse for people to dress up and drink all day, she says. Every year for a 3-day weekend, Catalina plays host to about 500 people in about 100 boats who dress in elaborate pirate costumes, fly skull and crossbone flags, and refer to every beverage they consume as grog. To participate in Buccaneer Days, you sail to a port on Catalina called Two Harbors. You can spend the days on land or sea, and you sleep on your boat tied to a mooring about 100 yards from shore. Unlike Avalon, the adorable tourist town on the far side of the island, Two Harbors is not a community. There are no structures to sleep in, only a flimsy outdoor bar, because you don't need a roof, but you do need beer. The moorings in Two Harbors are limited, and there's a wait list to lease one. Apparently applicants can wait 30 years for a spot. It's all very exclusive and old money. Whitney and her family strike me as far too normal to enjoy this kind of thing, but I'm grateful I've been invited along to witness the mayhem. On the day we leave, Alex and I are still confused about the concept as a whole, but very excited. We scour our closets for anything on theme, pick out every article of clothing with so much as a ruffle on it, and stuff it into a bag. We stop at CVS to pick up a bandana and an eye patch. Neither of us has problems with motion sickness, but we grab some ginger trips, a holistic alternative to Dramamine, just to be safe. Upon inspection, the eye patches are a light gray, which makes them look distinctly medical and sad, so we toss them. But we throw on our bandanas and take our ginger trips and drive to Long Beach. We arrive at the marina and spot our hosts looking spectacularly nautical. I would describe the size and style of our vessel, but I don't know anything about sailing, so I'm trusting you to picture a boat. The rest of the party is already on board. Whitney and her new husband, Brian, and her childhood friends, Katie and Cecily. Whitney's father tells me his name, but I forget it immediately and hope that referring to him as Captain for the rest of the trip will be endearing. Whitney then introduces me to her brother. Oh, unrelated, you know that thing when you meet someone and you're immediately like, huh, we're totally gonna have sex. Anyway, his name is Luke. We throw our bags below decks and get settled into a cozy little section of the cockpit to enjoy the fresh air. Being from Maine and not knowing how to sail is one of those things that earns me a lot of incredulous looks. Being from Maine is not the same as being someone who summers in Maine, so I don't want to ask too many questions right away. Whitney's father does appear to be the captain of the ship, and I surmise that Luke is a kind of default first mate. Oh, crafts this size don't have a first mate? Cool. I'm gonna call him that anyway so us poor kids can keep following along. The captain is having a conversation with someone on the dock about high winds. It sounds ominous, but we're so excited to take our trip that we choose to interpret the phrase, not quite gale force, as a green light. The family, except for Whitney's husband Brian, who's on the bow reenacting scenes from What About Bob, finish readying the boat while the passengers with no sailing experience chat and pass around a bag of chips. Luke is fiddling with something just behind me and leans down to whisper in my ear. Listen, I'm sure those chips are delicious, but this weekend you're the only girl I'm going to see in a bikini that I haven't known since I was 5. I'm counting on you. This is presumptuous and rude, but I am 21, so instead of jamming my keys through his calf, I find him incredibly charming. I make a big show of eating another handful of chips, then put the bag away and resolve to restrict myself to alcohol-based calories for the remainder of the trip. We get out on the water and it's beautiful, but we're met with high winds as previously threatened. We try to take photos, but most of them are blurred as the boat is tossed from side to side. The water is so choppy that a cooler of beer falls overboard and Luke leaps into action. He jumps into the dinghy and goes after the cooler. Everyone on board watches with bated breath as he rescues the cooler and a couple of runaway beers. He lifts the final can of PBR over his head and we cheer from the deck for our returning hero. I have a couple blurry photos of this, and that's where my pictures from this day stop. Once Luke and the cooler are safely back on board, the wind gets progressively worse. The boat is being thrown more than tossed now. We get past the breakwater, and I don't know it yet, but that means shit is about to go down. We take our electronics below decks and wrap ourselves in sweatshirts and jackets. Luke trims the sails, which is a thing you do on a boat, but it doesn't feel like it's made a difference. The conditions are a little distressing now, and we look at each other with goofy, surprised expressions, the way you do when an elevator jolts. It's scary, but it's fun, and we can already imagine ourselves telling the story later. We make roller coaster noises to confirm that, yes, this is fun. We're having fun. The water gets rougher and starts crashing over the sides of the boat. I'm worried about my hair getting wet and having that attacked by raccoon look in front of this new boy, but I don't want to seem high maintenance at a time like this. The swells only get higher, and soon what's coming over us isn't foamy spray but thick sheets of blue water. I want to ask if this is normal, but I don't dare. I'm afraid of drowning, but more afraid of looking ignorant and hysterical. Now that we are wet, I'm unbearably cold. I go below decks to change and maybe do the cowardly thing and stay down there for a while. Turns out the feeling of motion sickness is 50 times worse below decks, and I run back up, still in my soaked hoodie. That's fine, I think. Better to be up here anyway. Solidarity and all that. The wind gets worse. No one is joking or making roller coaster noises anymore. In fact, we can't remember how we ever could have been so cavalier about the sea. The captain is at the helm with a tight smile, reassuring us that he's not worried. He's seen worse. Luke is crouched down, bracing himself. He looks serious and ready for a fight. The rest of us are stone-faced, white-knuckling anything that's nailed down as wave after wave comes over the boat. Then, before I even realize it's happening, I am throwing up. I manage to thrust my body toward the side of the boat, but I'm still clinging to the center of the cockpit with one hand, so my breakfast, the handful of chips, and the hippie Dramamine go all over the deck. I stay in my awkward position, not wanting to face the group of seasoned sailors. I know that under the circumstances, no one will be angry, but I'm still humiliated. With waves coming over us at 10-second intervals, the evidence is washed away almost immediately, but still I don't turn around. I am a pathetic, weak-stomached crybaby, and I've never been so embarrassed. Then, before I even realize it's happening, Luke is throwing up beside me. For one moment I'm relieved, but it's short-lived. The first mate is violently throwing up next to me. This is a terrifying development. I'm a girl about to die on a boat, who just moments ago was a girl embarrassed about throwing up on a boat. I long for that simpler time. I turn back to the captain. He is no longer smiling. Whitney throws up. Brian throws up. Cecily goes below decks to throw up. She returns cradling her cell phone to her ear, risking its destruction to call her fiancé and say, I love you. I think about the last time I had to swim hard, but I've lived in L.A. for years, where no one actually goes to the beach unless they're staging a romantic paparazzi shot to dispel gay rumors. It's been a very long time. I throw up again. Who had we been an hour before? Who were those goons laughing and joking about the high waves? How could we have ever been so arrogant in the face of this inexhaustible power? We must be nearly there. We must be. I still feel sick, so I try to focus my gaze on a fixed landmark. I look back toward the California mainland, but it's nowhere to be seen. I notice the captain's galoshes are full to the brim with seawater, dark liquid splashing over the tops as we lurch. I stare at his overflowing boots while we hear mayday calls come over the radio. I don't care about my hair anymore. The journey goes on, and just as Whitney starts apologizing to us, the waves start to get smaller. The captain puts his tight smile back on to tell us that it's getting better, and he was never worried. He'd been through worse before anyway. When we see land, we behave like children who just found out that the neighbor's scary dog is chained to a pole. Take that, ocean! You can't get us now! With no immediate threat to my life, I remember that I'm in the presence of a hot guy and deflate a little knowing that I look like a drowned rat, and probably blew it when I threw up the second time anyway. The weather lets up completely by the time we get tied to our mooring. We take the dinghy to shore and dramatically kiss the ground because we think we're funny. There are little campground-style showers where we get cleaned up, and I do my best to fix my hair. Without a blow-dryer, braided pigtails are my only style option. If pigtails could become a really fashionable look for adult women, that would make my life so much easier. That or attacked by raccoon. As soon as we are in our dry clothes, we head to the one structure in the harbor, the bar. The handful of other sailors who also crossed through the rough water are easy to spot because of their thousand-yard stares and the fact that we are the only patrons not yet drunk off our faces. Everyone else is in full buccaneer garb using over-the-top "our matey" accents and drunkenly groping what I hope are their wives. Debauchery is clearly best executed in a costume, and everyone seems to have forgotten that this is real life. Alcohol might not be the best remedy for seasickness, but the inebriates are in markedly cheerier mental states, so we hurry to catch up. We spend the night on the boat, and by 8 the next morning, even through the thick hull, we hear the mating calls of functioning alcoholism. The sun is still low, but the good people of Buccaneer Days are already up and harassing each other. Groups of aspiring marauders are piled in dinghies and weaving through the sailboats, throwing plastic coins and bellowing, "Prepare to be boarded!" This is a lot. I'm not much of a morning drinker, but Luke has weed, so I gratefully smoke as much as he offers. It's like I'm at Mardi Gras, but it's balding and in the middle of the ocean. I'm getting a window into what it means to be an adult. Sometimes, being an adult means getting some friends together and whizzing around in a tiny boat, shouting jocular threats at the passengers of slightly larger boats. It's quite a thing to watch grown men and women brandish fake swords and climb aboard the vessel you're standing on to demand beer. The environment, and probably the weed, bring me to a few surprising revelations. 1. People need escape and fantasy at every age. 2. Maybe we're almost free when we're playing make-believe. 3. At least 5 people here have buried a stripper in their lifetime. My most piratey shirt happens to make my boobs look awesome, and 12 hours have passed since I last threw up, so I'm on the prowl. We get dressed and go ashore, and in the daylight I notice we are truly the only people here who are unmarried and under the age of 55. Well, this changes everything. Put me on an island with a cute guy and give him no other sexual options? This must be how socially adept women feel all the time. I won't even have to get that drunk. But I do anyway. The next 48 hours are a haze. We dance, we take the dinghy around the island, we drink more. We consume nothing but overcooked mystery meat and the bar's signature drink. A mixture of Kahlua, Bailey's, banana liqueur, and whipped cream known as buffalo milk. The combination of sugar and alcohol is probably shutting down vital organs, but we feel invincible. On our last night, some of us go ashore for a last hurrah, but Whitney and Brian stay on the boat to call it an early night. Luke and I sneak away from the party and make out in the grass under the stars. It would be romantic if we weren't dressed like off-brand theme park entertainers. I am drunk and very young, and sharing a near-death experience makes me feel like I can say anything to Luke. I tell him that watching Whitney and Brian stay on the boat made me depressed. Then I say that of course they stayed on the boat. Why would they bother coming out just to hang out with each other? Once you're married, there's no more excitement or possibility. I say settling down sounds like death. I say I feel sorry for them. I can't imagine anything more important than chasing that butterfly feeling. I can't imagine what would drive a person to get out of bed in the morning if you knew you'd never have that new crush feeling again, or ever dance on a table, or get so drunk you try to fight a stranger. To not come ashore on the last night of Buccaneer Days? It's tantamount to giving up on life. Maybe because he's a little older, or maybe because Whitney is his sister, Luke scoffs. He's right, it's stupid, I just don't know it yet. We get back on the boat and I go to sleep. I bunk with Luke, but we don't have sex after all because we haven't known each other very long and his family's on the boat, and I haven't taken a shit since we left LA. The journey back is easy and beautiful. When we arrive in the marina, everyone sets to work getting the boat back in order. Alex and I have no idea what to do, but it seems like asking would slow the process down. We move objects around at random to give the appearance that we're helping. The second it becomes acceptable to say goodbye, we run to my car, drive straight over a partition, and race home to the comfort of indoor plumbing. At home, we come out of our respective bathrooms, flop on the couch, and luxuriate in our freshly scrubbed bodies and vacant bowels. For the first time in almost 4 days, we are sober on land. Did you know that land sickness is a thing? Spend too much time on a boat and your body adjusts. We hadn't noticed it when we went ashore in Catalina because the only thing on that shore was alcohol. But now it starts to overtake us. I go to the kitchen thinking food will help and I am tossed about by invisible demons. My 10-foot walk to the refrigerator is perfectly flat, but I flail and grab at the walls like I'm traversing the galley of a sinking Navy destroyer. Alex and I look at each other, terrified. Surely this is just a delayed hangover. It will be over in a few hours. But the ocean is an evil bitch and she intends to torture us for days. I crawl back to the bathroom and throw up.
Why would grown people do this? These are adults with money, sailboat money, which would imply they're functioning members of society. Why go to an island and dress up like a pirate? The work of it, the expense, the planning, the last-minute acquisition of stick-on Captain Jack Sparrow beards. All to come home and spend the next 3 days feeling miserable. While I was there, I found this all bewildering but harmless. Yet I was undone by the simple act of husband and wife staying in one night in lieu of participating in what was clearly a collective psychosis. Not long after that weekend, something started changing in me. I started to feel like I was just playing the part. The first time I noticed it, I was in the middle of a Herculean effort to enjoy dancing at a club in Vegas. Even while it was happening, I thought, this will be one of those things I look back on that makes me glad I don't do it anymore. Later that night, Buccaneer Days crossed my mind. I still didn't know why anyone would want to go through all that trouble to behave like an idiot. To this day, I behave like an idiot plenty, and I don't need a pirate costume to do it. But I realized I'd want to stay on the boat. I'd want to stay on the boat, cook some mystery meat, and listen to a podcast. So many people I know who are in long-term relationships have made the same boring comment to me about how they wish Tinder had been around while they were single. Seriously? You wish you could be on Tinder? Tinder seems like a gateway to years of therapy or having your organs harvested. These comments are usually made by married men who feel that they would clean up if only they could get their incredible faces in front of the masses of younger women who they've heard are way more into anonymous sex. So many people say they wish they could be young again. You couldn't drag me back to 21. All the hiding, all the pretending, all the hanging out with people you don't actually like. Going out 3 nights in a row? RuPaul's Drag Race is on. Making out in the grass? I own a perfectly good couch. Always fighting with your friends? I am no longer confused about what the word friend means. And to top it all off, if you woke up tomorrow and you were young again, you'd have to deal with creepy married dudes feeling entitled to easy sex with you because your generation is supposed to be more liberated? Pass. That new crush feeling, it just makes me tired. I thought that urgency, that need for the new experience, always thinking the next one might be better than the last, and the terror of potentially missing out on one would be there forever. These days, if my hair got fucked up in front of some cute boy, I'd just think, hey, at least we're speeding up the inevitable. If you still want to spend some of your short time on Earth with this whole situation, let me know, because it's what you're going to get at the end of the day. Pitying the couple who didn't want to semi-ironically hobnob with strangers in pirate costumes was pretty childish of me.
But I'm glad I have the memory of that feeling, because now I can fully appreciate how wonderful it is that it's gone. I wonder how much of my hard and fast worldview will change as I get older. Surely I will always hate licorice, I will always love cheap-scented candles, and my favorite movie will always be George Cukor's The Women. Surely I will always put work before relationships, I will always think that children aren't for me, I will always find Buccaneer Days baffling. Or maybe in a few years I'll get the urge to sail to an island, spend the weekend getting hammered in a tri-cornered hat, and realize I was a fool for ever questioning it. The world's most reluctant adult. I was in a rush to grow up my whole childhood. Because I looked so young as a kid, I worked doubly hard to prove that I was independent and mature. I got called precocious a lot. I didn't know the word had pejorative connotations until I grew up and started using it as code to mean, this kid is annoying, and the circle was complete. When I was 9, I bought a mini fridge for my bedroom with my allowance money. It was $50 at Walmart, and I saved like a champ for my big purchase. I thought it would make me feel like I was living in a little apartment of my own. Instead, it sent me into a panic about all the things I would need to be a true adult. A microwave, a toaster, wooden hangers, a coffee table books, a little jar for cotton balls, a bike with handbrakes even though the pedal backward brake seemed perfectly fine to me, and a mop. For our wall-to-wall carpeting, what was wrong with me? I returned the mini-fridge the next day. I felt like I either had to become the perfect adult human all at once or give up and stay a kid. I let my anxiety get the better of me and chose to stick my head in the sand. I'm still doing battle with this anxiety, and it's left me a bit of a man-child. I know I'm not a man, but woman-child doesn't sound quite right. Girl-baby? Lady-tyke? I'm getting into creepy porno territory, so let's stick with man-child. You know what I mean anyway. With every birthday, I've stupidly expected to feel different, only to discover that I'm still me, tragically lazy and childish. Every birthday, I think, this is the year I won't drown myself in store-bought cookie dough when I'm anxious about something, and every year I'm wrong. Even as I say this, I'm thinking, next year, though, it'll be better. The book will be done. I won't schedule myself so thin. I'll have enough time off to teach myself not to get overwhelmed. And I really believe it. It's pathetic. The truth is, I just want to be a man-child for another 3 months. Perpetually. Can you spot the tiny flaw in this mindset? I have no doubt that I'll need the help of a very skilled therapist to break this cycle, but I keep hoping it will correct itself. Every now and then, I test the waters of self-improvement with some practical changes to see how far I can go without succumbing to anxiety. Just small things at first. I stopped buying fancy underwear. Easy. I've bought so much of it in my life, and it turns out guys are way more excited about naked boobs than they are about boobs in a lacy red bra. Fancy bras are uncomfortable, and they look lumpy under anything I'd wear on a date anyway. Also, every time I've worn fancy lingerie, an awkward dance ensues where I try to pause in between the removal of the shirt and the removal of the bra so that the gentleman might admire me. It's even worse with jeans and underwear. Trying to keep your adorable knickers on when peeling off skinny jeans is like trying to get a Reese's peanut butter cup out of the wrapper without the bottom layer of chocolate coming off. I've come to my senses, and it's white cotton comfort all the way. Bam. That wasn't so bad. I'm also working on becoming the kind of adult who does not engage in stupid, dangerous situations, even if that makes me look uncool. You know those videos on YouTube of a flash flood where someone is way too close to the water and they're standing there like, wow, that water is rising fast. I'll just take a few more pictures and I'll totally be able to get out of here before I'm in any jeopardy, and then they're dead. I want to be the person who runs away from the flash flood like a little bitch and lives to tell the tale. I'm not going to be the person who shows off by leaning too far into the dolphin enclosure and then gets raped to death by dolphins. Google it, nerds. I'm going to be the person who tells her friends not to get too close to the dolphins, gets made fun of, and says I told you so at their funerals. I used to be the idiot who would climb to the 5th floor of a construction site at 2 a.m. just for the story. Now the most reckless thing I do is ignore emails marked urgent. It's a real rush. I'm trying to make big decisions without asking an adult, because that's me. I'm the adult. For 10 years, I drove Charlie, my scrappy little used Toyota. When it came time to buy a new car, I decided to do it on my own. I'm financially stable. I'm a homeowner. I vote. But I'll admit, it felt weird not consulting my parents. I bought Charlie when I was a teenager. I'd used my own money, but my mom was with me the whole time. I had no idea how to buy a car completely on my own. So I brought Aubrey Plaza. Aubrey's got kind of a father figure vibe, so she gave me a certain confidence walking into the dealership. Aubrey was accidentally helpful in the negotiation process because she's batshit crazy.
I was getting frustrated with the cliche trappings of the process and kept asking, do we really need to do this? You're going through the motions of being the sleazy used car salesman, but couldn't we just talk like two normal humans? Aubrey sat in the corner and occasionally interjected, my uncle owns a dealership across town and we could just go there. He's also in the mafia, without looking up from her phone. We were less good cop, bad cop, and more cop who hates negotiating, cop having a psychotic break. The technique was effective regardless. I went home and called my mom to tell her I'd bought a car. Maybe that kind of thing is newsworthy enough to warrant a call to your mom anyway, but my motivation was that of a child who'd learned to tie her shoe. What's the point of being so independent if you don't get a gold star from your mother for being such a big girl? Maybe the next time I buy a car, I'll wait a week to call her. If my current track record holds up, I have until 2024 to develop that kind of restraint. The further I get into self-improvement, the more I hope I'll grow some new part of my brain that makes me take care of my responsibilities automatically, like highway blindness. If I grabbed my keys for a Krispy Kreme run in my sweatpants, I'd come to 20 minutes later wearing pleated khakis and getting my oil changed. Sadly, I am conscious through every excruciating moment of paying my parking tickets on the DMV website and cleaning a little bit each day so that it doesn't pile up on me. I expected to take an interest in my retirement plan, understanding general car maintenance and doing my laundry on a schedule instead of 3 days after I ran out of underwear. But just thinking about that stuff makes me want to lie on the floor and eat packets of Easy Mac until I feel too swollen and turgid to do anything but dream up elaborate ways to murder everyone who says life hack. I power through. I'm still an embarrassment to civilized society, but now I change the toilet paper roll instead of resting it vertically on top of the old one. There's hope. The trickiest areas to improve are my fitness habits. When I work on them, it's great for a while because they don't feel so sluggish and I have fewer mood swings. But then it's shitty because healthy food tastes gross. Naturally luminous, perfectly proportioned people are always full of helpful tips to set me on the right path. Oh, aloe vera water is the new chia seed? Cool. I'll just work up the reserve of self-loathing I'll need to choke down that spit-flavored miracle drink. Why don't I just eat powdered egg whites until I pass out? Yeesh. Add food issues to the therapy list. When it comes to exercise, I'll start out slow. Just an easy hike. The next day I'll be too sore to move, but I'll say the reason I can't hike again for a few days is because my allergies to sunlight and pain are acting up. I don't know who I'm saying that to. Obviously, I don't invite anyone to witness these feeble attempts at physical activity. Being healthy is testing my commitment, but I'm feeling pretty good about my monthly dose of seeing the sky. Then I have to make the bed, and that's where it all falls apart. I hate making the bed so much, way more than I should. I can't make my bed without collapsing into a full-on existential crisis. So, you made the bed. It looks nice, but you're just gonna get back in bed tonight, and then you'll have to make it again tomorrow, and on and on and on, and then you'll be dead. And then I start thinking, well, why do any housework? Why do the dishes? You're just gonna get them dirty again. Maybe you should just start eating every meal with your hands bent over the trash can. Why work to improve any area of your life when everything good that happens is going to require more and more maintenance? Maybe giving up on this adulthood thing wouldn't be so bad. In movies and TV, the man-child always has a moment of clarity and gets his act together for his wife or his baby. But what if I just didn't? What if I just kept returning the proverbial mini-fridge? When I'm in full man-child mode, I sleep until 10, dopey and sweating. My only motivation to stand the promise of an ice cream sandwich to start the day. The mid-morning sugar crash isn't a problem when my only objective is to sit as still as possible while watching Naked and Afraid. People might roll their eyes at me, but they're just jealous because their hearts of palm ceviche sucks. Sure, my muscles are atrophied, but stacking my dirty dishes in the sink and leaving them there has become a veritable game of high-stakes Jenga, so my physical dexterity really isn't in question at this point. Food and housework aren't the real problem. The real problem is that I let anxiety cripple my relationships. I blame this paralysis on different things. It started as a money issue. I was too broke to go out. I didn't want to spend money I didn't have on dinners and drinks in the movies. I didn't want to invite anyone over because my place was gross. Once I had an income, it became a time issue. I'm working too much to go out. Even when I do have a free day or two, there's this overwhelming guilt about planning anything recreational. I haven't been to the dentist in a year and a half, but I'm going to go to Lacey's party out of the question. I mean, I still won't go to the dentist, but making fun plans would force me to acknowledge that I'm not going to go to the dentist. I get that it's not a money issue or a time issue. It's just a me being a malfunctioning life form issue.
I think I need to become perfect all at once, so I keep getting overwhelmed and putting it off. I can't remember the last time that I didn't have something hanging over my head. There's usually about 30 to 80 things. Is that normal? Don't tell me. If it's not, I'm a jerk. If it is, that's super depressing, and I know I'll just use "this is normal" as an excuse to procrastinate even more. I know that feeling isn't unique to me. Yes, I'm away from home a lot, and I keep the hours of a meth-addicted puzzle enthusiast. It takes as long as it takes, okay? But everyone in the world feels like their inbox is growing faster than they can keep up, right? If there was just a little more time, or a little more money, or if you could just get through this one last rough patch, it would all be clear, and it would all fall into place. It's an insatiable trap. And yet, I always think, this is my year. This year I'm gonna get my shit so together that I'll always be able to see the solution to my problems. I'm gonna get it so together that I'll never have to get it together again. It's like this Tyler Durden-style feeling that I'm so close. I'm so close to being a real person. I'm so close to making time for friends and family. I'm so close to being able to take out the trash without checking that none of my neighbors are outside because small talk makes me feel like the world is on fire. I'm so close to being wonderful. Sometimes I get tough with myself. You are unbelievable. Nut up and fix your problems. You come from a long line of poor Irish women who were perfectly self-sufficient, and by the way, they had like a million babies a year. Then I'll play good cop. Hey, buddy. Maybe you could just answer a couple of emails today. The one from your insurance company doesn't seem too scary, and you don't want to go to jail for driving uninsured, do you? No, of course you don't. And you're making money now? Maybe get a cleaning service to come by, like once a month. No pressure. Just so it doesn't start looking like a fucking episode of Hoarders in here, okay? But I fight back. Balance? Moderation? Discipline? These are just the many names for smug used by bitches who lie to us on their lifestyle blogs. That's right, clean food, CrossFit mom one. I know you've got a pile of fun-size Almond Joys in your glove compartment. Now go sit in your driveway and eat your candy while masturbating to Tom Hardy like a real woman. You can see how I would think that emotional adulthood is right around the corner. I'll just be a man-child for another 3 months. I swear. Scrappy little nobody. I don't want to brag. I realize my elite lifestyle and celebrity status might intimidate you, but my car has keyless entry. That's right. My little beauty just needs to sense my presence, and as long as I have my keys in my pocket, she opens up like a gross sexual metaphor that's demeaning to women. Meow. When I go out of town and drive a rental car, sometimes I will approach it, keys in pocket, and pull on the handle of a locked door. Well, it's an embarrassing situation, to say the least. I'm forced to push a button on a clicker to enter my motor vehicle, like some pleb. We've been hanging out long enough that it's cool for me to make jokes like that, right? It is an embarrassing situation because expecting my car door to be magically unlocked makes me feel like a little spoiled idiot baby who doesn't remember a time when she had to insert a key into a lock to get into her car. Why won't this open? Every time this happens, it reminds me how quickly we take formerly miraculous things for granted. No Uber? How did we get places before? No Wi-Fi on this flight? I might actually die of boredom. No navigation on my phone? So I have to print out directions from the internet? Or look at one of those, big paper things? Is it pronounced map as in cap or mape as in vape? I don't want to become complacent. Lazy is something I've always been, but complacent and entitled I want to avoid. When we made Up in the Air, George once said that actors have a bad habit of thinking that however well their career is going, it will only get better from there. Well, not me. I'm going to assume that the world could collectively turn on me at any moment. I suppose I should try to find a balance, but that seems harder. Film actors are treated like useless idiots because we often are. But I started in theater, damn it. I used to sleep on the floor of the Port Authority at 14 waiting for the bus home after traveling 6 hours to New York for one lousy audition. This was my dream, and I don't want to get used to any of it. Now where is the chilled oxygen I ordered? When I first moved to LA, I didn't have a TV, so I went to my one friend's apartment to watch the Oscars. It was the year that Charlize Theron won for Monster. I watched her walk down the red carpet while I ate my questionable bodega hot dog and imagined that she must have spent the previous 3 weeks being expertly massaged and manicured in preparation. This was the most important night of her career. It probably wasn't, but I thought that at the time. The most important moment of her career was more likely a day on set actually doing her job. I assumed that a team of specialists were working around the clock to monitor her food intake, skin regime, and eyelash density. When I was nominated, in the weeks leading up to the Oscars, I thought, doesn't anybody care that I'm not going to the gym and I'm falling asleep in my makeup every night and I'm eating like Macaulay Culkin in the first 30 minutes of Home Alone? Isn't anyone going to stop me? When is my Charlize Theron team going to parachute in and tell me what to do here? I thought celebrities never had to take care of anything themselves. In fact, I'm still guilty of thinking this now. I look at anyone richer or more famous than me and think, well, yeah, if I had a team of assistants, a nutritionist and a trainer, I'd have Justin Bieber's abs too. The weird thing is not how much people interfere with your life, but how little. No one wants to be the person to tell a celebrity they need to watch what they eat or cut down on the boozing or maybe just go see a good old-fashioned therapist. Obviously, I already know I need to see a therapist. You don't have to tell me. For the most part, I'm on my own. Well, I get lots of help when it comes to things I would gladly avoid, like showing up to junkets or putting on real clothes for those junkets. The people who sign my checks know that I'd be cool with skipping them altogether. They send a small army to make sure I do it. But when I need a ride to the doctor because I've gotten bronchitis for the 8th time in 6 months, I'm drinking a Red Bull and getting behind the wheel. And you know what? That's good. It builds character. I never want to build character. It's fucking awful. But it keeps me from becoming reliant on other people. I don't want to be like Paris Hilton telling some judge that I didn't know my license was suspended because somebody was supposed to read my mail for me. I want to tell a judge that I didn't know my license was suspended because I don't have my shit together, but at least that's how I've always been. My ineptitude is not the result of fame. It's part of my God-given personality. I spoke to Colin Firth at a party once, and before I shared an inappropriate story about watching Bridget Jones's Diary on Ambien, he told my boyfriend and me that a few weeks earlier, he'd gotten a flat tire on a country road. It was a very charming, self-deprecating story about how silly he felt not knowing what to do, and how he took a deep breath and figured it out because he refused to behave like some helpless celebrity. Quite unfairly, my boyfriend and I started to use Colin Firth as shorthand for freezing up in the face of a minor problem. Sorry I'm late, baby. The air conditioner kept turning itself off all day, and I had a bit of a Colin Firth moment. Never is this truer than when I stay at a nice hotel. It's so fancy, it's so well-appointed. It's so pleased with itself for being the height of luxury that when I can't locate a power outlet in the first 90 seconds of looking, I get unreasonably distressed. When I stay at a Motel 6 in Sarasota, Florida, I'm perfectly comfortable. Can't find a mini fridge stocked with sparkling water? Of course you can't. You're at a Motel 6. At the crappy motel, I know I have to count on myself. And despite all evidence to the contrary, I can rely on this old gal to come through in a pinch. I want to keep it that way. I don't want to become helpless. Some people think it's weird or uncouth when I do normal things, but people who actually think things like, ew, why is Anna Kendrick buying toilet paper? Doesn't she have an assistant or something? Are the same people who would think, she has an assistant buy her toilet paper? She's worse than a terrorist. So those people can choke to death on their own miserable worldview. Kisses! Conversely, some people act like I'm a literal hero for completing the smallest tasks without assistance, and I agree. Someone get me a medal. Recently, a very sweet teenage boy stopped me on the street in Brooklyn. He asked for a photo and said, how are you just walking? He knew what he was asking didn't exactly make sense. I told him that walking wasn't so bad, but I'd consider hiring a rickshaw the next time I left the house. He laughed, but I still think part of him was surprised I was executing a basic human function on my own. I want to be a real person, even if that person wasn't so great to begin with. I want to always be able to say, hey, I'm not incompetent because I got famous. I'm incompetent because I'm a pathetic waste of humanity. But I'm not about to let it get any worse. I don't want to be the guy who has to call an assistant the next time I get a flat tire. I still don't know how to change a flat tire, but I do know how to call roadside assistance. And I'm not going to let myself turn into a recluse because I'm embarrassed to be seen outside the context of perfectly glamorous situations. So if I come into your local 7-Eleven with a gown hiked up around my knees asking for directions to my own premiere because the GPS broke, be cool about it. I recently had jury duty. It was the second time I'd been called to perform my civic duty since moving to California. When I told friends I was doing it, the majority of them balked. They make celebrities do jury duty? We're just people. Of course they do. Yes, obviously I was hoping that being famous would get me out of jury duty. I wasn't going to be the dick who called someone up and said it, though. I did ignore the notice for several months. I was shooting a movie out of state and worried that if I called to postpone, they wouldn't let me. On the other hand, if I called once I got home and explained that I had only unearthed the summons upon my return, how mad could they be? Better to ask forgiveness than permission. I know, it's the logic of a fool who goes to jail for ignoring a jury summons. But it turns out I was right. I had my rambling apology/excuse locked and loaded, but they rescheduled me without asking for one. I'll admit I wondered if I would run into any problems. I really do assume that most people won't know who I am, because in my experience, they don't. Still, I never know when I'm going to be a distraction, or when a municipal employee might offer to smuggle me out the back door in exchange for, say, a signed 8x10 glossy. No, but seriously, I didn't want to interrupt the noble pursuit of justice. I reported to a downtown courthouse without incident. The only person who approached me was a young woman in a pink tracksuit. She said she liked me in that movie where the dude had cancer, and she liked how it was funny and he didn't die. I asked her if she'd served jury duty before, and she said, "No, I'm not here for jury duty. I'm waiting to go into court." I have a fan who might be a criminal, or a falsely accused political dissident, or an unorthodox lawyer. Well, realistically, she's probably just some girl in a civil dispute with her tyrannical landlord. This was exciting. The prospective jurors got called in for orientation, and I said goodbye to my new friend, the criminal or hero or citizen. There were probably 100 people shuffling in, so I took a seat at the very back of the room. So far, so good. We watched a video of former jurors talking about their rewarding experience with such forced enthusiasm, I suspect that their loved ones were being held at gunpoint just off camera. Then a woman in a business suit and orthopedic shoes gave us a speech about how, as long as there wasn't any nonsense, we'd get along fine. I was starting to feel so anonymous that I got that lovely, familiar, alone-in-a-crowd sensation. She continued, "There is no photography in the courthouse. Now, you might want to take a photo because maybe you see a famous attorney, or a famous defendant, or maybe," she raised her hand and pointed to the back of the room, "even a famous juror." Was she pointing at me? Dude, for real, are you pointing at me? I'm being so stealthy. I'm all the way in the back of the room. You said no nonsense. This is definitely nonsense. Well, she put her hand down. I guess she's not going to say anything, but anyway, she's just a juror today, so don't bother her. Lady, I was doing fine before you did that. Luckily, the other jurors were paying about as much attention as plane passengers during in-flight safety announcements, so almost no one turned around. The rest of the day, we waited in the orientation room to find out if we'd be put on a case. I sat in a corner and read some Philip K. Dick and tried to be inconspicuous and ate vegan for lunch because it turns out Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is way more about empathy for animals than the Blade Runner movie. In spite of whistleblower McGee, no one seemed to notice me. I didn't end up on a trial that day. Perhaps whistleblower had spared me to atone for her earlier nonsense transgression. But outside of that, the only incident that reminded me I was famous was when a sweet older gentleman asked me if I was reading my book for research to be in the movie version. No, this is actually already a movie. They changed the title to Blade Runner, but they actually made it in the 80s. Oh, he said. I thought that Frenchman who did Sicario was remaking it. You know, the one who always works with Roger Deakins. Oh, shit, Grandpa. That'll teach me to underestimate a fellow Los Angelino. There are plenty of places in the world where I am correctly treated like I ain't shit. My personal favorite is my hometown. While I was in the middle of writing this, I went home to see my parents. I turned off my phone, stopped checking my email, and hung around Maine long enough that I pushed through the awkward small talk phase with my dad and managed to get him talking about Sergei Prokofiev fleeing Stalin's regime, which is his version of deep chat. I slept on my mom's sofa even though she kept offering to make up the bed in the basement because I liked waking up to bright snowy mornings. We took long walks around her neighborhood, each time stopping by her favorite neighbor's house to say hello. The two young boys whom she often babysits were always thrilled to see her and could not have been less interested in me. It felt like how the world should be. Being around my family and the place I grew up reminded me of my fear that I was getting too comfortable, that I was letting myself atrophy. When the apocalypse comes, my total lack of practical use in the world will make me a first-round draft pick to be cannibalized. How did I become so useless? Everyone else in my family is resourceful, brilliant, a problem solver by nature. I recently tried to kill a spider by chasing it around with a saucepan. There are several holes in my bedroom wall now. The spider lives on. You see what I mean? During the visit, I went through some childhood photos. After 4 shoeboxes of winter camping and historical fort pics, I didn't find out until I moved away from home that other families went to Disneyland for vacation. I found this little doozy. You can check it out in the attached PDF. This picture proved to me that my entire personality was fully formed by the time I was 3. I was an obstinate, determined little ball of anxiety. I'd thought of myself as fearful and shrinking in childhood, but I was often single-minded and pugnacious. From age 3 onward, I have been practical and skeptical and occasionally more courageous than I have any right to be. At 3, I'd decided those were the tools I needed to get through this life in one piece, and those tools aren't going away. It was a wonderful discovery. It would make me so sad if naturally happy, open, kind children could be changed by their experiences and lose those qualities. My particular personality traits seem less worthy of preservation, but they're my own and I love them. I hate them a lot, too, but I can rely on them. I shouldn't be so worried about changing as an adult. As an adult, you get to turn to your boyfriend and say things like, "I've always found the obligation to say God bless you after a sneeze really arbitrary and mannered. When we're at home, can we stop saying it?" And then you get to stop. You have all this agency. You get to decide what kind of person you want to be, and yet you're still the person you were at 3 years old. Isn't that kind of great? I think 3-year-old you would be proud. I put that picture on my desk so that when I feel sorry for myself, her fearsome little face will be staring at me saying, "Get off your ass and fight, woman." I rarely give advice. Your personal growth only makes me look worse by comparison. But as a suggestion, find your most psychotic baby picture and have it on hand for those days when you want to throw in the towel. It's both joyful and effective. I hope that you found this entertaining and maybe, my highest goal, it's made you feel less alone. If we ever cross paths, I hope you have a good experience. I will try to be open and not squirrely. I can't promise I'll be nice because nice isn't really who I am. Pygmy ferret cornered and ready for a fight is more like it. Footnote. I wanted to put more shit talk in here, but I figured I should be diplomatic since I'd like to continue working for at least a few more months. I'll write another book when I'm 70. A better woman might let go of past conflicts, but don't worry. I hold a grudge forever. This has been fun. Oh, man. Is my Wikipedia page gonna say author now? That's gonna make me look like such a dick. Bonus reading group guide. Welcome to the completely real and very serious reading group guide for the magnificent book Scrappy Little Nobody. Below are a few questions to help you get the most out of your listening experience. Footnote. If you happen to run a trashy celebrity news blog that requires you to peruse the content of privileged cretins like me, first of all, I am sorry. And second, you may use these questions as a template for creating misleading but juicy headlines. By the way, I get it. Famous white girls are really fun to be mad at. Book club meetings should commence with an interpretive dance based on your emotional journey through the book. Refreshments, preferably a variety of Pop-Tarts and a dry Prosecco to be drunk from the bottle, should be served liberally throughout proceedings. We hope these discussion points aid the further appreciation of the material you've just heard. 1. Though every page of Scrappy Little Nobody is perfect in every way, which part is your favorite? Make a list, it can just be a post-it that says every part is my favorite, and tape it to your chest for the rest of the day. 2. Discuss the metaphor of Anna moving to Los Angeles without a motor vehicle. Was this an illustration of her tendency to self-sabotage, or did she just not look at a map of the city before she moved, like an idiot? 3. Why do you think Anna chose to disclose her childhood affiliation with the KKK? Was the guilt finally too much for her? Or is she trying to make white supremacy feel accessible and fun for a new generation? 4. When Anna compares Zac Efron to Charles Manson, is she making a joke or trying to warn us about a potential murderous mastermind? 5. Does Anna hate all Russians or just the one man who teased her about her name? Does her xenophobia stem from this experience, or simply being raised in an era when all bad guys in movies were Russian? 6. The book opens with the author's mother wishing for a few stories in which Anna comes across as thoughtful and/or generous. Did Anna's mother get her wish? Was there a single story where Anna didn't seem eminently punchable? 7. In the section about Alexa Chung and Olivia Palermo, the author viciously maligns two innocent and very fashionable girls. Is Anna a shady, basic bitch, or the shadiest, basicest bitch? 8. What was up with that one chapter about sailing being in the present tense? Sure, Anna's editor thought it was weird, but it's what Anna wanted. Who was right, the pig-headed author or the noble and very pretty editor? 9. Did Anna steal that money from her neighbor's pizza party? Did she include the story to hide her crime in plain sight? Let's petition to get her tax returns released and finally take this bitch down. 10. Why does Anna want to engage in a Valentine's Day orgy? Is she simply desperate for human contact, or does she not understand acceptable social boundaries? 11. Anna makes a lot of bad decisions. Can you think of a time when you've made a bad decision? Oh, wow. Really? We're gonna pretend you can't think of a single example?
You think you're better than me?
Scrappy Little Nobody was written by Anna Kendrick and read by the author. It was recorded by Eric Cifuentes at the Invisible Studios in Los Angeles. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan.